Our next keynote speaker, which is none other than Jacqueline Peterson. Jacqueline Peterson is the director of the NAACP Environmental and Climate Justice Program. Since 2007, Peterson has served as coordinator and co-founder of Women of Color United. Jacqueline Peterson has worked as a researcher, program manager, coordinator, advocate, and activist on working on women's rights, violence against women, HIV and AIDS, racial justice, economic justice, and environmental and climate justice. Peterson served as a senior women's rights policy analyst for ActionAid, where she integrated a women's rights lens for the issue of food rights, macroeconomics, and climate change, as well as the intersection of violence against women and HIV and AIDS. Previously, she served as an assistant vice president of HIV/AIDS programs for the IMA World Health, providing management and technical assistance to medical facilities and programs in 23 countries in Africa and the Caribbean. Patterson has also served as the outreach project associate for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and research coordinator for Johns Hopkins University. She also served as a U.S. Peace Corps volunteer in Jamaica and West Indies. Patterson is and has multiple publications and articles published. She holds a master's degree in social work from the University of Maryland and a master's degree in public health from Johns Hopkins University. She currently serves on the International Committee of the U.S. Social Forum, the Steering Committee for Interfaith Moral Action on Climate, Advisory Board for the Center for Earth Ethics, as well as the Board of Directors for the Institute of the Black World, a Center for Story-Based Strategy, and U.S. Climate Action Network. Let's give a warm welcome to Jacqueline Peterson as she comes to take the stage.
I guess it's right. East Coast time. So it's good to be with you all. I arrived here in Madison at 4:30 this morning, having gotten in late to Chicago and then driving up. And as I sat in this gas station, kind of nodding off with a couple of sheriff's cars that had arrived, I was sitting between in the gas station. I thought, I've got to get to this next system. And I just revived myself and get there because it's such an important conversation that I'm glad to be having with you all. We really do need to talk about how we're going to work together to really affect this radical transformation that we need to make sure that we're realizing the rights that are now being infringed upon rampantly across the country. In Flint, Michigan, where I've spent the better part of this year so far and where I'm headed after I leave here, it's a concentrated representation of everything that's wrong with our current system. The ills that are being felt by all of us in different ways, but which have combined in Flint to comprise a fairly hyper-toxic set of circumstances on multiple levels. And so the progression of how it happened and how it's unfolded and the impacts that it's had on Flint residents is everything that we need to change in terms of the system, starting with the fact that General Motors was there and other industries were there, and that they were there and acting in fairly unregulated ways in terms of the pollution that they generated and dumped into the air, which caused really very poor air quality at the time that they were operating, and also dumped into the waterways, and then were able to leave that it was able to be dumped there in the first place, and B, that they were able to leave without cleaning up the mess that they made. And so that, again, is part of where Flint is today. Also, the fact that the whole community was really dependent on this corporation and its operation in order to be a viable community. And so when it left, Flint was just was just rendered without an economic engine for the community, which is another representation of the challenge around not having a community-centered economic engine and having something based on someone who's coming in from the outside. And the fact that it was what we classically call a sacrifice zone, where the community members there were there, and they were benefiting to some extent from the economic aspects of the company being there, but they also had all of the ills there in terms of the health and environmental health challenges there, while, you know, in order to be able to create these cars, many of which are not necessarily needed by all of us in terms of the excesses of how we do transport. Also, as it's evolved now with the emergency manager situation, where we have a governor where in Flint they have it's located in Genesee County, where the county did not majority vote for Governor Snyder. So you had someone who they didn't necessarily elect themselves. Then removing the only democratically elected governance that they actually had in the form of the mayor and the city council, and imposing this emergency manager. So someone who was not of the city, who was not elected by the city, making decisions for the city. And again, based only on the bottom line in terms of finances. And so then we saw what resulted from that. I don't need to kind of give you the background around that. But another piece that could mitigate against the situation is that there was an environmental justice law or plan that had been put in place before Governor Snyder was elected. And when he came into office, he shelved that plan. So again, the only thing that could have possibly, you know, caused folks to examine the impacts of the water and so forth on the community was shelved by this governor who wasn't even elected again by this community. And then this all fell on a situation of such extreme blight in a lot of ways, particularly with the most vulnerable aspects of the community. One of the things that we know mitigates against the absorption of lead in our systems is good food, good nutrition, and so forth. And Flint is located in an area that is extremely food insecure, what some folks call food deserts, but other people in the environmental justice community don't like the word food desert because it implies that it's a naturally occurring thing. And we know that, you know, the fact that there is no grocery store at all within the Flint city limits is as a result of these historic issues and the disinvestment that has happened in the city of Flint. And so, that's a deliberate at worst, but a neglectful, non-caring, again, sacrificing this community because it doesn't have any use for people in the ways that people define this community as useful. And so not only do they not have grocery stores, what they do have is these dollar stores. And if anyone has read any of these stories about the toxic products that are produced by dollar stores, and these are the products that people are relying on because that's what people can afford, and therefore that's the only kind of business that's viable there in terms of where people get their products. So they have, you know, contaminated water, and then they have these contaminated household products that they're bringing into their homes. And then we also, there's a proliferation of liquor stores there. And so we all know the good and bad there, for depending on one's take on that. And then just with the city's infrastructure issues, because it doesn't have money, as I was driving through there, I was struck by the number of potholes that there were in the cities and the fact that there wasn't really snow cleanup after a big snowstorm. So all of that kind of, you know, makes it, you know, if you do have a car, and most folks don't, it actually makes it even worse to be able to drive there. Insurance rates are higher there and so forth. So all of these things, again, just combining to make the situation so much worse. And then before this whole disaster happened, they had a redevelopment plan that they were being put in place. And it included demolishing 80% of the homes on the north side of Flint, which again is the largely African American side of the city, but they were kind of putting it out. Part of the revenue for doing this, and part of the ways that they were selling this, was talking about it being now a green zone. So again, this kind of greenwashing of displacement, yes, that happens all too often in different places. And so when I was there, there was, as folks may or may not know, lead and another thing that's found in the water, which is manganese and some of these other metals, are actually tied to behavior issues and even tied to violence, according to some studies. And when I was there, actually at the hotel I was staying at, which was right in the middle of Flint, one person was murdered, and that was in my hotel. And that was a third person who was murdered within a 24-hour period in Flint. And this is a town of 100,000 people. So again, we see, and last year is supposedly one of the largest rates of murder that they've had in a while. They're still waiting for the numbers to come out, but the early numbers indicate that. And so not only are we seeing potentially those that tied the tie in terms of violence, but we're also looking at the future impacts, because the permanent brain damage that we're talking about from lead poisoning. There's nothing that we can do for a lot of the kids there. And just recently, there was an article about a woman who who miscarried both of her twins. And lead exposure is something that actually is directly results in low birth weight and with compromised birth outcomes. And one thing that's also little known is the fact that Legionella was also in that water, and that 87 people had Legionnaire's disease during the switch to the new water, and 10 people died of Legionnaire's disease. So 10 people dying in a place of 100,000 people of Legionnaire's disease is extreme. So I just really wanted to kind of lay, and also I'll just end in that Flint reflection by saying that the other thing there is that even in the response, there are folks who are disproportionately impacted, for example, incarcerated persons who weren't ever put on the other water supply while other people were getting these water bottles and getting it. So they were continuing to not only drink the water, but they were cooking with the water. And unlike other things where if you boil the water, it makes it better. With lead, if you boil the water, it makes it worse. And so they were cooking with water and feeding people who are incarcerated. And we all know that in communities like Flint, the racial profiling that goes on, and you know,
there's a word for that.
Yeah, the mass
you
incarceration
may not be able
issues.
To say it, but I'll say it.
Yes, thank you.
Genocide.
Yes, absolutely. So, and then we also had undocumented persons where the ways they were giving out the water, similar to our voting laws, they were actually giving out the water and you had to present an ID, a photo ID, in order to be able to get the water. So undocumented persons went for a while without the water, access to the water at all. So who knows what disproportionate impacts we'll see there. So again, from kind of the systemic underpinnings to the lack of places where the community could have been resilient, to even the flaws in the system that was meant to give aid. And also on the very last note I'll say in terms of that, is that the water distribution, not only are there places where people can pick up the water, but there was also folks that were delivering the water, and that was done by the National Guard. So again, you would think, that these are a group of people and so forth, but unfortunately, they're armed guards. They're coming in the communities with flashing lights. So when it first happened and the community didn't know that that's how they were going to be delivering water, they would go onto their street and think, oh, another person was killed or another violent act happened. And the first thing they would think was fear, like who was my community member, who was in my family, as they would drive onto their streets and see these flashing lights. And one person talked about, as an African-American male, being afraid to open his door to people who are armed bringing this water, because he said, if I had got a call and reached for my cell phone, would they think I'm reaching for my gun and shoot me down in my own doorway? So these are the kind of conversations that folks were having, and the kind of system-wide issues from kind of cradle to grave in terms of these impacts, and literally grave for many, many people there now and who knows in the future, and folks who didn't even have a chance at life in terms of the people who are miscarrying. They're actually looking now to see if there was an extreme spike in miscarrying during this period, because they've already noted a number of people who've miscarried. And so we see just how flawed the system is and how that can really impact one community in so many different ways from now and for literally generations to come. So with the community groups, the frontline community groups that I work with through the Climate Justice Alliance and beyond, we're centered around this whole issue of distribution of wealth and real democratization of the system. In Flint, as an example, when, as we've gone in and had these community consultations with folks, and they've put together this 20-point plan based on just literally just rooms like this where everyone's just brainstorming, and all we did was write it down. We didn't ask any probing questions. We didn't add any things that we thought would make it better. We literally just wrote down what all the community said in terms of what they wanted. And they came up with everything from, you know, taking the same revenue that they're bringing to bring in the National Guard and providing jobs to local youth. They came up with, you know, of course, replacing the water infrastructure, repealing the emergency management law, having a grocery stores and so forth, but not just grocery stores that are, you know, owned by Kroger or whatever, but locally owned grocery stores, and also having a local food movement where they can grow their own food to the greatest extent possible. They talked about making sure that from now on they have a local hire provision and a disadvantaged business enterprise provision so that, again, those jobs don't come in, people don't come in capitalizing over the situation, as we saw the disaster capitalism that happened after Hurricane Katrina. So they came up with just 20 comprehensive, and it included a research agenda, it included making sure there's transparency around the research, it included a community oversight board to make sure that there's participatory budgeting and transparency there. And so it really a comprehensive agenda for moving forward that also let us know that if they had had representational governance from the beginning, because they know exactly what they need in order to build a resilient community, then that a lot of this, or maybe none of it, would have happened in the first place. It also included reinstating the environmental justice plan. And it included doing a community-wide assessment, like, because we know that the water isn't all of the threat that Flint is facing. And so it's a comprehensive plan that's community-led, community-envisioned, and, you know, community-designed. And again, if all of those pieces were in place, this likely never would have happened in the first place. And so the work that I do with Climate Justice Alliance is looking at this vision of this next system and this new system. And as Gar again very reasonably noted, the devil is certainly in the details in terms of what the next system looks like. I was on a panel recently where I was advocating these new systems of democratization of energy, and my two co-panelists, and also food systems, and my two co-panelists, who are both far more conservative, refer to these ideas as utopian concepts. And so that was all very, it was a white male panel and me, and I was like talking about my pie in the sky ideas according to them, and they were talking real talk about reasonable things that could happen.
Pardon? It is pie in the sky if they're going to eliminate all of us by killing us one way or another.
Well, there we are. So,
I have a question about Flint.
Oh, okay.
You'll have questions at the end?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So the fact was, I didn't necessarily know exactly what it looks like to decentralize food systems in terms of how all of the community gardens and the community-supported agriculture would really fit together, and how do we do it to make sure that it totally works and that everyone is fed. I didn't know what it looks like to have decentralized energy systems and how all of the solar gardens and rooftop solar, offshore wind, and so forth fits together to make one interconnected energy system, or even a series of microgrids that make sure that it keeps all the lights on and all the things going that we need. I don't know necessarily how a series of community-owned recycling centers combine and how best we handle the materials that can't be recycled. These are, you know, with the minds of community leaders, engineers, economists, scientists, and others, all whose heads need to come together to design this new system. But what I do know is that we need this new system, and that what we've got now is fundamentally flawed and on every level. It really needs to be the vision of the community, and then those who can help to figure out the system needs to work together on that. So we know that right now the corporate monopolies that currently rule the system, that's resulted in the sacrifice zones that I just described in Flint and otherwise, are keeping these systems in place through, you know, using the profits that they make by using cheap technologies or cheap processes that pollute all of our communities, using those very profits to suppress the very laws that we need to have a system that affords all rights for all people. As just some other broader examples, the National Mining Association has fought against rules for coal mine dust year after year after year, at the sake of their community, of their very workers, where 76,000 coal miners have died of black lung disease since 1968, while year after year after year, they fought against regulations for coal mine deaths. And so the examples are just so many where they use their profits to actually willfully remove the rights of people at the stake of their very lives. And so whether it's illicit financial flows, trade laws, taxation laws, personalizing corporations, and so much more, the fact that the system just kind of feeds on itself in terms of generating and regenerating and holding on to these same policies that continue to suppress lets us know that the system is completely broken. We really need to, you know, as we all know, while we're all here, revolutionize how we're doing all of these things. And so when we talk about this work now, we talk about also the meantime. Like, what are we going to do now as we build towards that radical transformation that we all need? And a lot of times we talk about resilience and we talk about resistance. And right now, the groups like Gulf South Rising are saying that they don't even like the term resilience, a place where that's hit after hurricane as a result of the excesses that we have in our society. They don't want to talk about resilience when it means that they want, you know, someone else is telling them to be resilient to something that they're doing to them. I liken it to someone walking up to me, handing me a pair of crutches that they bought for me, you know, very generously, before they mowed me down with their car. So it's really, that's where a lot of people feel who are constantly in another kind of version of a sacrifice zone. And so they really talk about the frame of resistance. And we know that we already have a lot of resistance that's going on that's effectively routed out some of the systems that we talk about, whether it's the Shell No campaign that was successful in stopping the one portion of the drilling. That right here in this region, the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization in Pero, who shut down two coal-fired power plants in Chicago and are looking at a just transition. Gulf South Rising, Gulf Futures Coalition, and the Gulf are really looking at ways that they can have that, for example, they're doing a no new leases action on the 23rd, where the government is thinking of, you know, granting all these new leases for the Gulf of Mexico. And so we're seeing these kind of resistance happening while we're also building resilience in terms of reforming our disaster systems to make them more centered on civil and human rights. We're looking at redevelopment plans to make sure that we aren't building climate adaptation plans or sustainability plans to end up redeveloping us right out of our land and our homes, as we're seeing so often in terms of displacement. So while we're working for this larger system, where we're community garden by community garden, solar garden by solar garden, community-owned recycling center by community-owned recycling center, we're building towards that through 1,000 points of light, and hopefully we'll be able to work together to make this the next system so that all of these various disparate actions become one unified system. So that's my 20 minutes. Thank you all.
We are going to take just a few questions for either Jackie or Gar. So I see Howard, you in the back, and then were you raising your hand? Okay.
Well, I want to thank both Gar and Jackie for the great presentation. Really made me think about a lot of stuff. So I was a member of the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization, and five of us, including the chair of the Department of Environmental Science at Knox College, he wasn't a member, just an ally, we made an appointment to visit Evergreen on the way to the 2010 U.S. Social Forum. We were really impressed by the laundry. I'm an occupational medicine physician as part of my work, and that was the best laundry I ever visited in terms of how the workers, you know, what they had to do ergonomically, et cetera, et cetera. We didn't get to see the solar project. We just heard about it because there was something going on. And then we went back to their conference room and were served very generously some pizza. And the person who was in charge at that point of the greenhouse project, which hadn't started yet, then gave us her Wall Street card because she had just started there and didn't have her Evergreen card yet. And she described the process. So here's my question and comment. I think the question is not just worker ownership. The question is democracy in making decisions about very important things. In this case, what's being grown in that greenhouse and where is the food going? So we asked those questions 5.5 years ago, and we were told exactly what's happened. The food is all going to go to upscale restaurants, upscale grocery stores like Whole Foods, et cetera, and none of it at that point was going to go to the community, and the community, including the workers, had no decision. Even the workers who at that point were owners had very little decision about what food was being grown there. So that's my question. My comment is about co-ops. The question of co-ops is, do they really affect the overall global, local, and national capitalist state? So the world's largest co-op is Madelon. 75,000 workers, $12 billion in business every year, and Spain, you know, in terms of the capitalist system, is very happy to let people. It had no effect on what's going on in Spain. Right up the street here is Organic Valley, 1,800 farmers, $1 billion. I'm not saying these aren't good things in itself. My question is, what is that going to do to the overall system? Because I think Jackie's comment towards the end is the key. Capitalism is going to keep growing in the wrong way.
Yeah.
It may not, continue to grow in the same way, and I think your comments were really appropriate. So those are my two questions, one specifically about Evergreen and one about the whole system.
Take it in. Yeah. Those are really good questions. So let me take them quickly. I want to have time for we've got three questions, and I'm sure Jackie's going to have them. So the woman you're talking about is no longer there. So that's just important to know that you met. There's a new group in. The second thing to know about this is, and this is really tricky stuff. The second thing to know about the Evergreen model is that it is not the model for the future. It is a sketch upon which maybe somebody might learn how to take the next step. That is to say, to build anything serious at this stage is going to be compromised. That's what Evergreen is. It suggests what could become. The Rochester model is the one to look at. And that will be flawed too, because building on this, but trying to take a new step from what we learned in Evergreen. Evergreen gives you a sketch. The one beyond Rochester will give us another sketch. That is the process of trying to learn how to actually do this. And I don't want to be over. What I'm trying to suggest is that this experimentation is happening all over the country, and it's getting more and more sophisticated, and it's all compromised. Let me say that again. Anything at this moment of development will be compromised. The question is how far and how fast. Second thing about making decisions about how to do markets. In fact, it turns out that you need knowledge, and we haven't developed people with knowledge of how to do that. We're just beginning to learn that process. Evergreen is totally a startup, it's an experiment. So I don't want any illusions about that, but it does suggest the possibility of what you might do when you take the next round and the next round and next round, and you can get now what we're learning from Evergreen and now from Rochester and now from New York and now from Madison and now from Austin, and then you can get the mayors in. You've got a progressive mayor to finance this kind of development. So that's a long discussion, but hard, hard question. You want to develop this stuff, it will be compromised and inadequate until you keep taking the next steps. No illusions. That's number one. The larger question, let me see if I can pose the larger question that you've asked. Put it another, give me the short version of it. I want to be sure I answer it properly.
Well, I really encourage people to read last year's monthly review article about co-ops under capitalism versus socialism. So that's the question.
Yep.
We could have a million co-ops and not necessarily change the state. Who controls the state, the nation, the United States? And what are the forces at work? So how does it challenge the actual capitalist system?
Good.
You know,
I'm with you on that one.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm not.
You know where I am on that one. Co-ops are useful in some places. They are, and they're more complex co-ops like Mondragon. I'm not a great fan of Mondragon. Mondragon has some positives and some negatives. Mondragon got clobbered in the world market. And they lost one big piece of the Mondragon because of the competition, because there was no state to back them up. Co-ops suggest that in some markets, in some areas, one form of democratization of capital. That's a principle. They don't handle the state. If you go to larger levels of the city, of the neighborhood, you need more complexity. Evergreen's a sketch. You need city ownership, that's a municipality in some areas. You're going to have to get to state ownership at larger scale, regional probably, and then ultimately national. The principle I think involved in actually, and I write a lot about this, so if you go to my website, you'll find this kind of stuff is what I spend a lot of time on. The principle of actually decentralization to the lowest level possible unless you've got a scale problem of where you put public ownership becomes the way I would think about it. That's the principle of how you do it in a continental system of 300 million people, 325 million people maybe. How you do that becomes the question. I'm not going to answer that. But co-ops do one thing. They introduce the idea of common ownership. And that's one step. In the period of development, and this is what the next system project's about, exactly trying to answer your question. I don't think you can have a system of co-ops. And I don't think Mondragon or Emilia Romagna give the answer. I think they begin to introduce principles in a longer struggle that need to be introduced into this culture. And from my own view, I think you're going to have regional ownership, and I think you end up with national ownership at large scale. But decentralization to starting at the neighborhood, working your way up, becomes the way I would talk about it. But I'm not a, I mean, I like co-ops, there's no problem with them, but I don't see them the answer.
Yeah, so it just so happens that I just came back from Jackson, Mississippi, where I actually met with the group called One Voice there, and they actually have a program around the rural electric co-ops in Mississippi. And what was fascinating is, just as we said, having a rural co-op in this existing system means that even though they have these great principles of how these co-ops are supposed to be, they have these seven principles of co-op, of rural electric co-ops, the way it's run is just like any other corporation. Like they've done this kind of basic survey of the communities that these co-ops are in, and none of the community members that they spoke to actually knew that they were owner of these co-ops. They had no idea. All of these customers are supposed to be co-owners of the co-ops, and none of them had any idea, much less did they know what their rights were as co-op owners. They also found that, you know, at Mississippi is, I think, 48% African American, and there were 6% of the co-op board members were African American. As you know, there was 52% women, and 4% of the co-op board members were women. And so, so not only do we have this kind of, you know, just absolutely not operating in any way like they're supposed to, there's also these representational issues. And finally, there was, the way the co-ops are run, they're supposed to, when they make a profit, they're not supposed to make a profit. So the money's supposed to go back to the communities, and they literally have been pocketing or spending on other things all of the money. There's just been hardly any dividends that have been provided to the communities. But one thing that's exciting about the One Voice Initiative is that they weren't just kind of there, you know, exposing all of the flaws of the co-op. They actually are going to do a Know Your Rights campaign and really work with communities to actually seize ownership of their co-op. So hopefully we can see what it looks like to actually run a co-op in the way that it's supposed to be run through this kind of long-term initiative. So I just wanted to let you know, hopefully that'll inspire a little bit, and hopefully that can provide models.
Yeah.